I'm ready, Mr. McCabe.
Take it away, Mr. Mercep.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercep. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately. And of course, we're both very pleased to be back with you because we've had somewhat of a midwinter break.
We have indeed, so we have a little bit of catching up to do today. We're going to be taking a look at the latest epic from British director Christopher Nolan, who absolutely seized our attention with his telling of the Second World War's disaster that ended in triumph at Dunkirk.
Sure did. Our heads were also rather turned by a film which was billed as a romantic comedy, but it had plenty of substance too. It was a cross-cultural story called The Big Sick.
And who needs Black Widows when you've got atomic blondes? I'm going to be taking a look at Charlene's... It's not an easy name to pronounce, that one. Charlize Theron's latest attempt at being a kick-ass secret agent.
And she can kick-ass with the best of them, I suspect. I will also have a brief word on Spider-Man Homecoming, and I'm posing the question, is superhero fatigue setting in, or is this roller coaster still hurtling along as quickly as it ever did?
I've stepped away from the usual films and music routine to spend an evening with Neil deGrasse Tyson, that rarest of things, a rock star astrophysicist.
Not only have we gazed into the stars, or at least you have, Steve, we've also looked at music, or at least I didn't, and I don't think you did either, really, but there was an act called Little Mix. It's a great boon for us, Steve, that Debbie, our regular guest reviewer, yet again took one for the team and went along to see Little Mix. Debbie, hi.
Hi, Simon.
I'm going to profess absolute and utter ignorance, Debbie.
Okay.
It's not a good thing for a reviewer to do, but I have not heard of Little Mix. Where have they come from, and what sort of group are they?
Oh, okay. Well, they started out on X Factor, apparently, back in 2011, if I'm not mistaken. They auditioned separately, and then, as sometimes happens on X Factor, which I'm not very familiar with, they were put together as a group. And they were the only group to win X Factor.
Aha. Uh-huh. And they're a group of men, women, young,
they're
old?
What? Four young women in their 20s from England, from the UK.
From the UK. Mm. Are we talking about a pop group? Would that be fair?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, where did you see them?
Saw them at Spark Arena.
Uh-huh.
Formerly known as Vector Arena. Spark's great, by the way. I really like what they've done.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What have they done, just quickly?
Well, I think that their the way that they handle crowds is done very well. I won't go into that a lot, but it actually seemed nice, so check it out if you haven't already.
Okay, cool. All right, so four young British women singing pop music. I'm guessing the audience was pretty young.
Yes.
What did you make of them?
I thought that they were good. I've heard their music before. There's a few songs I really, really liked. And I can't remember the names of them. I'm not a big fan. I have to say that. But I was looking forward to enjoying their music, which I did. I did go for the sound check, which was kind of fun. It was about... I think it was like at 3:45. So I was at Spark Arena for a very long time, Simon.
you sure were?
Yeah.
You're a dedicated reviewer.
I am indeed. So soundcheck was kind of fun. Got to see the girls, or young women as they really are, in their, just regular clothes and, just having a little bit of fun, answering a few questions. So that was really nice. There was a lot of young women in the crowd, of course, and they seemed to just really enjoy the sound check. There was maybe about 100 of us, I guess. Then we were led back out of the arena, got back in line and waited for the doors open to around 7 or 7:30. And there was an opening act, and I can't remember her name, actually. Do we have that written down somewhere? Anyway, she was an Australian woman doing basically just DJ stuff, and she was absolutely adorable, but I have to be honest, it was kind of unnecessary. We really didn't need her as an opening act.
Okay, fair enough.
I know, sorry.
Yeah, so people wanted to, the crowd wanted to see Little Mix, and when it came to the actual proper show. How do they do it? I mean, I'm interested to know with young pop artists these days, whether they have a live band, are there backing tracks? How do they put it on?
They did not have a live band, backing track, and none of them seem to play any instruments. They're basically just vocalists, and I'm not sure if they write their own songs, but the songs have the sort of lyrics that young women would probably really enjoy, things about kind of getting back at your ex and, you know, things like that. They had a song all about their hair, which was kind of fun.
yes.
But to me, it didn't really feel like it was worthy of sort of a live concert.
Okay.
Yeah, they were dancing, they were singing, there was, you know, no band. That's really about it.
Yeah. One of the things I'm kind of curious about just is how they, the image they put out on stage. I mean, we're so used to, the issue of whether they are playing things up for a young audience in a, you know, about talking about relationships, are the lyrics or is the way they're dressed, was it very mature? Was it very juvenile? What?
Yeah, it seems like their demographic should be a much more mature audience, but there are quite a few young girls in the crowd, like as young as 10 probably. So they're, you know, highly sexualized dancing and lyrics I thought might have been a bit much for girls that young, but yeah.
Okay. And a final thought is, I understand it didn't last long, Debbie.
They played for just under an hour and they did come out for one encore song and that was it.
An hour? Gee, that doesn't sound like a lot these days.
No, it's not. I would have expected an hour and a half from a group.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, they could take turns to go singing the lead. all right. So if they come back, would you go again?
No, I wouldn't. Once is enough.
Okay. We'll take that. Thanks.
Okay.
That was Little Mix at the Spark. Hey, Debbie, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Simon. Mama waste my life, she said. Spread your wings, my little butterfly. Don't let what they say keep you up at night. And if they kill you, then they can walk on by.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Debbie. That was great. Steve, we'll hit back into some films now. I guess you've listened to Debbie and you're just so sad you didn't get along to see Little Mix. I can just imagine.
I will get over it eventually. Actually, hang on, wait. Hang on. Yeah, I just got over it. Yeah, I'm good now. Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, great, good. Now, let's talk about... So well done. Let's talk about movies, shall we? And let's start with the film that I reckon we were both talking about this. We were both really hanging out to see this one. This is Dunkirk, written and directed by Christopher Nolan, the Brit. Now, Steve, I've read your review on our website, cravepodcast.com, and as that tells us, you thought this was a quality piece of work, did you not?
I was quite taken with Dunkirk, and let's face it, how can you not be? You've got one of the most thoughtful, intelligent, sophisticated filmmakers at work at the moment. You've got a spectacular cast, and you've got a story that just eats at the soul. It's hard to know how you could go wrong with a film like that, and obviously he didn't.
We should talk about the structure of it, which was really interesting, wasn't it, Steve? I mean, because I guess any filmmaker tackling something like this, you've got the conundrum of dealing with an epic event, and he does that, doesn't he, with, you know, wide sweeping shots of the beach, lots and lots of extras, so you do get a sense of the scale of what's going on here. But at the same time, he's chosen a very clever way of telling some personal tales to give us something as an audience to sort of relate to on an individual level. And he's done that using three timelines. I thought that was pretty clever.
Yes, it's not immediately obvious that that's what's happening. It takes a while before that sort of clicks with the audience. But he tells the story. And do we need to even do a plot synopsis for something like this?
I don't think we probably do, no.
No.
No, you're right. There's a little at the very beginning. We're introduced to three scenarios, and there's a bit of writing talking about where we are, and there's a time frame. And as the film progresses, what you understand is that the story we are seeing on the beach and the soldiers is playing out over a certain period of time.
Yes.
The story of the civilian boats, and we're focused on one boat in particular that's crossing the channel to try and help these soldiers, that's playing out over a different period of time. And then finally, we've got the story of the Spitfire pilots in the air doing their darndest to try and protect the boats on their way to rescue the soldiers. And that's being played out in a third period of time. And what he's doing here is he's laying these timelines out, isn't he, Steve, as the film progresses, they eventually do intersect. So that's pretty clever. And it's something he's done in other films as well. Memento springs to mind. But yes, he likes this idea of layering the story.
Indeed. So you've got on the first story of the mole, which is the landing point where the big ships were trying to pick up escapees. And so we have Fionn Whitehead as Tommy, who is trying to figure out how he can get himself onto one of the rescue ships, and he's struggling, but he's absolutely desperate because he knows that if he stays on the beach, there's a real chance that either he won't get away at all, or they were sitting targets for Luftwaffe planes to just come along and pick them off as they stood on the beaches. Remarkably British thing to do, queuing up on the beach.
I wasn't.
It was profoundly British. You've also got, as you say, you've got Mark Rylance as a civilian on the waterfront in England, who takes his little pleasure cruiser, the 20-odd miles across the English Channel, to see who he can help out to pick up. And then you've got Tom Hardy providing the best air cover he can in a Spitfire that's patrolling the beach as far as possible. And again, these three timelines eventually coincide. But and in the meantime, we're presented with, I don't know about you, but I found combined with Hans Zimmer's score, the most oppressive and claustrophobic view of the battles that you could imagine. It was terrifying to watch in places.
Yes, I agree. I think it was expertly put together. And that soundtrack, which is something that Nolan has used something similar in other films, that idea, you know, that at times he uses almost like a single chord that he sustains over a lot. That was used, I remember, in great effect in the third Batman film he did. And he uses it here, and it's absolutely gripping. It gets your pulses going. And when it's combined with intercutting between the various scenes and the sound of that, those Stukas coming in, it just makes your bones shudder. And it's incredibly effective. It really was gripping at times.
It was. I mean, it's not an easy watch. It's not an entertaining film.
Yeah.
However, it is compelling, and it's profound, and it's powerful. And it's done with virtually no dialogue.
Yeah, that's true. I noted that too, Steve. Very little script, but you didn't need it. The pictures were so strong, the soundtrack is so strong. It just drives it along. Can I just ask you? I've got to ask you this. The ending is memorable, and we do come back to this incredible Spitfire, and I can see why young British boys must have looked on the Spitfire pilots as absolute heroes of the day and probably still continue to do so. There's a scene at the end. I think I have to mention this. It's been out for a little while, so I'm going to assume that most of our podcast listeners have seen the film, Steve. And if you haven't, forgive me. But we do see a Spitfire gliding.
Yes.
Okay. It seemed to glide for a long time, and it's really important to what's going on in the story. It's climactic, but it just in the back of my mind, I was thinking, can that really do that for that long? And it just did distract me a little bit. Did you get that at all, or were you just completely swept along by it?
Oddly enough, as a flyer myself, I did take a particular interest in the way the flying scenes were depicted. There were one or two things about the Spitfires that very slightly troubled me. If you remember, that there are two Spitfires lost, let's say. The first one goes into the water,
Yes.
And there's a lot of tension due to the fact that he couldn't, the pilot can't escape the cockpit because the canopy is jammed from the impact in the water. However, when the second one is being glided down, as you point out, on a very protracted glide, the first thing on his checklist is open the canopy. So you do wonder why the first pilot didn't think to open his canopy.
Yeah.
That did bother me a little bit.
Yes.
The other thing is you're right, the glide did seem to go on for an awful long time. Now, you can stretch your glide. There are things you do with your airspeed and your flaps and all the rest. There's things you can do. But one thing I did enjoy was the fact that they used very authentic old-style language to talk about their altitudes, and they repeatedly referred to being at Angels 1, which is 1,000 feet off the ground.
Okay.
And if they're flying at 1,000 feet, I do wonder how they're stretching the glide quite that far, especially when they're in the middle of a dogfight as well.
Yes. So what happened, I did a little bit of searching around on the internet, Steve, and I've come across some references to apparently Spitfires being able to glide for quite some distance. But I just think the way it was presented in the film, it would have raised a question in the minds of many people watching it. And all it needed was a little line from someone on the ground saying something like, oh, man, there those Spitfires go again. Yeah, aren't they incredible how they can glide? Or something like that to just give us a little bit of a steer, because it just distracted just a little bit. It nagged me a little bit. And it looked like the way that sequence was cut, it looked as if he actually shot down a German fighter plane while he was gliding.
It's, as I say, it certainly leads you to believe that could have happened.
Yeah, and I'm mentioning this because the film was a really, really good film. I mean, it just, as you say, compelling and gripping. And that to have a little thing like that just nag away, it just spoiled it just a little bit. I don't want to overplay it, but I wish he'd found a way to deal with that and so that we all accepted it when we first saw it for the first time and we just got to not be distracted by it.
Now, I think another point you're making, because it's such an utterly immersive experience that to be taken out of it for any reason is an awful shame. But to be fair, if you were going to use that line, you would put it in the mouth of Mr. Dawson, Mark Rylance's character, because I think that if I had a criticism, I would say that what little dialogue there was in places quite clanging.
Right, okay.
And in particular, where Rylance is rattling off statistics about Rolls-Royce Merlin engines when a Spitfire went ahead. It just felt a little bit, didn't like that too much.
Yeah. All right, anyway, I think, and it's not unnatural, that we might have the odd quibble, but I wouldn't want to really distract from what is a really impressive piece of filmmaking, I thought, and I certainly would recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, because you still have people like Cillian Murphy as a pilot they pull out of the water, and as Rylance points out, no, he's not a coward, he's just shell-shocked.
Yeah.
But by God, he's shell-shocked.
Yes, yes, he did that very well.
But then this is Cillian Murphy, of course he did it well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And isn't it funny that this is the second time that Christopher Nolan has asked Tom Hardy to act in a film with basically just his eyes? He did that in the Batman film when he played the bad guy called Bane.
Yes.
And again this time, I mean, Hardy does it very, very well.
He was quite fantastic. And the utterly phlegmatic and unflappable tone of the Spitfire pilots. One of the one point in the film says,
yes.
Yeah, yes, well, obviously you'll just have to bail out now, of course. It's just, it was fantastic. I mean, we know that. I mean, there doesn't even need to be other nominations for the best score Oscar at this point.
Oh yeah.
If Zimmer doesn't win it, there's no justice in the world whatsoever.
I agree with that. I agree.
And I fully expect to see this probably getting Best Picture and probably getting Best Director as well.
That would be very interesting. He's due for it, so that would be great if he did. Okay, so we both reckon you should get along to see Dunkirk if you haven't already.
Absolutely. In fact, even if you have.
Okay, let's move on.
Right, so let's change gears utterly, I think. I think it's time for the complete other end of the spectrum, a romantic comedy.
Yes.
Because Dunkirk's many things, but let's face it, it's neither romantic nor a comedy. And one with a lot of good press attached to it is The Big Sick. But am I being fair? Is it a romantic comedy?
Yeah, well, you know, I wasn't so sure in the end. I've decided, Steve? I'm calling this film a sandwich.
A sandwich?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've decided that's what it is. It's two layers of romantic comedy, top and bottom, with some sort of family relationship drama as the filling.
Oh, okay. And I like that. Yeah, I'll take that.
Yes. Yeah, I think it was a good film. This was a good film. But I do think that as the days have passed since I've seen it, I've found myself more attached and interested in the dramatic part and less attached to the cross-cultural comedy, which was nicely done. It was, but it wasn't done in a sort of an incisive way that's lingering with me. I'd still give it a tick.
Absolutely.
What's your sort of overall reaction to it, Steve?
I thought this is one of the loveliest films I've seen in quite some time. It's based on a true story, which I think is one of the most remarkable things of all. Kumail Nanjiani, I believe his surname is pronounced, Pakistani, American stand-up comedian who met his wife when she heckled him in a comedy club. And so he wrote the script and he plays himself. And his wife Emily is played by Zoe Kazan. And it tells the story of their relationship while he is being set up by his mother with nice Pakistani girls for an arranged marriage, which he's got no interest in because he's falling deeper and deeper in love with Emily, who he can't quite tell that she's never actually going to be the one because he's expected to marry a nice Pakistani girl. And so the humour that comes out of that is outstanding. I don't know about you, I thought the chemistry on screen between Nanjiani, I beg your pardon, and Kazan was fantastic. I thought those two together were just utterly adorable.
They were good. They were very, very good. I enjoyed it. They played it. And what was good about it, Steve, was they didn't over-egg it. They didn't overplay it, did they? It was played in a – I think you used the word gentle in your review, and I agree with that. It wasn't ramming the story down your face. It had a kind of an intelligence about the way it was written and performed. It had an air of reality about it. Why perhaps I wasn't utterly taken by that was I feel like I've seen the cross-cultural comedy quite a bit depicted in film and television.
Yes,
and
I can accept that.
And I don't think it was as well done as it was, took me to anywhere different on that score.
No.
What I enjoyed more, as it turned out, was the less comedic aspects, they were played expertly. This is we meet, as the story develops, Emily's parents.
And it's worth mentioning that happens when the big sick itself happens.
Yes, so that's right. And so just before Emily falls ill, she and Kumail fall out, don't they, basically?
They do.
And so it looks like the relationship has perhaps come to a fizzly sort of an end. But when she falls ill, Kumail is thrust back into what's going on, and he meets Emily's parents, who are played wonderfully well, in my opinion, by Ray Romano and by Holly Hunter. And I think they have comedic aspects to the way they play it, but they really, really give you a sense of your average middle-aged white American couple who are having to deal with a Pakistani guy who they don't know how to sort of talk to, especially Ray Romano. And there's some lovely moments where he's clumsily tries to stumble his way through that. But I found for me there was some real dramatic meat in those scenes between the couple themselves and between them and Kumail. And I enjoyed that probably more than I enjoyed the romantic aspects between the lead couple. For some reason, I'm not quite sure why. I've enjoyed both Ray and Romano and Holly Hunter as actors, and I just kind of gravitated to that in the film, and that stayed with me longer. That's not to deny your appreciation of the comedic aspects of this, Mr. McCabe, however.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, what I was impressed with was even as you've got the combination of issues of Romano's blundering but innocent racism, you've got Hunter's reproachful, "You're breaking my daughter's heart" nonsense. You've got the all three of them concerned that they've got no idea why Emily's been put into a medically induced coma. And even in the depths of that, you found that they managed to dredge out a lot of genuinely funny moments.
And yes, that's not an easy one to pull off, because really, I mean, think about it, like most romantic comedies, you have the setup that lasts for about 20 minutes, and that's where all the jokes come, and then it just becomes like it's just like just waiting for it to end, when they're inevitably going to fall, get back together again, and this somehow I genuinely think they managed to keep the humour going all the way till the end of the film, and that's a rare achievement in a film like this.
Yeah, it's very well done. One thing I just thought of as it was progressing was that Kumail, who's, you know, he's playing himself, he's written it. I wonder whether what would have happened if he'd chosen another actor. And I just wonder whether, especially in the scenes between he and his parents, he's very reasonable when he's dealing with them.
Yes.
He's almost, dare I say, for me, I just felt like it was almost a bit too nice. And some people think that's rich coming from me, but however, it's almost like he didn't want to, because that can't have been an easy thing to go through. I mean, it must have been really, really hard. And I don't think his comedy, he glides over that, which is maybe
his in-laws must have known he was preparing this film. No matter how successful the film is, he's still got to live with these people for after the film's released. I think as well as that he clearly has affection for his in-laws. I mean, the two characters were, you know, they come off as decent people who, to begin with, were simply ferociously loyal to their daughter, but eventually warmed to him. And I think, you know, what we're seeing, in my opinion at least, is just his affection for them. He clearly likes these people.
Yes, no, I agree. And that, I think that's the great strength of the I almost think the relationship between Kumail and his in-laws is almost what I enjoyed most about the film, actually.
Okay, I can accept that. I mean, bottom line is, it's a really, really entertaining film.
It is. It's well recommended. Oh, gosh, we've got two winners here today so far.
Absolutely. So should we move on to the next one then?
Yes, I'm wondering if this is going to be a winner. Now, I have to say, Steve, I don't mind a good action thriller. And one film I've seen it being advertised, I've seen a trailer, and I haven't quite got to it yet, but it's called Atomic Blonde. One of the reasons I'm interested is because of its Oscar-winning lead actor, Charlize Theron, and also because I think James McAvoy's in it, who is a pretty decent actor. You have seen it.
I have.
Should I bother?
Quite possibly.
Oh, okay,
and I'm reluctant to commit a whole lot further than that. And let me tell you why.
Okay, please do.
Well, here's the thing, right? The story is this. You've got Charlize Theron as Lorraine Broughton, who is a British secret agent sent to Berlin as the wall is about to fall. So it's set, you know, late 80s, and the wall actually does indeed fall during the course of the film. So that gives you a nice time frame there. And she's sent there to investigate the death of another agent, David Percival. That's James McAvoy.
Right.
And also to try and recover a list of secret agents with the incredibly creative code name of, you'll never guess. It's called The List.
No.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And so the way the film's structured, it's not quite Nolan territory here, but it's a decent structure. She is in an interview room with Toby Jones and John Goodman, who are the British and CIA handlers who need to debrief her. And are watching through a glass window is James Faulkner, who's the head of whatever section she works for within MI, whichever one it might be, who's listening in. And so she's telling the story in flashback, and every now and then it chops back to the interview, one of either Goodman or Jones will say, "And what happened next?" And then we flash back to the action in Berlin. And it's all very stylish, and it's very noirish, and it's very dark. And that comes largely from its heritage as originally a graphic novel, I think we call them, don't we? A comic book by Anthony Johnston called The Coldest City.
Oh, okay.
And it's very stylish. And McAvoy he manages to avoid the temptation of going over into sort of like chirpy, cheeky, chappy. right. territory. Right. But he does make the point that, you know, he's been in Berlin so long that he's become part of the city.
Right.
And they try and exfiltrate Spyglass, who's an East German agent played by Eddie Marsan. And the whole thing is very entertaining in many places. There's a lot of style and panache, and there's a lot of verve to it. We've got a French agent named Delphine Lassalle, who hooks up with Lorraine Broughton romantically, and the retelling of that bit gets James Faulkner's section chief a little bit hot and bothered as she's talking about it. And this is Sophia Boutella, who was the mummy. And
I think she might
have redeemed herself. I'm not completely convinced yet. And so it all plays out reasonably agreeably, and it starts off slowly and it builds up a little bit. And by the end, there's a twist every 5 minutes.
Right.
And it's eminently entertaining. John Goodman packs an awful lot into the few seconds he's on screen, as does Toby Jones, because that's the kind of acting talent you've got there. Eddie Marsan's as brilliant as ever. James McAvoy is James McAvoy. You're not going to go far wrong there. And you'll notice there's one name in that little roll call that I've avoided mentioning.
Yes. What have you got to say about Charlize Theron?
Well, the one note she played very well. Yeah.
Okay.
That in the end is the problem. Lorraine Broughton is a kick-ass agent, and asses get kicked, but she does it in a very, very, very relentlessly gruff and grim, frowny, scowly, nothing else. And as I wrote in my review on our website, there was a time when James Bond films were just played for laughs, and Roger Moore was just camp and obnoxious, and everything was a witty quip and then a raise of the eyebrow. And then we got to Daniel Craig, who actually has a bit of grit to him, and suddenly James Bond films are worth watching again. And unfortunately, Charlize Theron has carried on that continuum, and there isn't with one line possibly be the exception at one point when she first meets Delphine Lassalle, and they're trying to negotiate a language to speak in, and she points out to us, "I'm not speaking German tonight." And it's a lovely line that she delivers with a nice little arch crispness. But apart from that, everything is scowly, and everything is intense, and everything is very harsh. And you're thinking, you know, I understand that it's a dark film. It's got one of the most amazing pieces of fight choreography I've seen in a long time, which leaves at the end of it, you feel bruised just watching her demolishing five blokes in a staircase, kicking the living crap out of them, in a scene that, quite frankly, looks almost as though it was filmed in one take.
Oh, wow. That is impressive. Yes.
Although at one point I did catch myself wondering, can you spot the join? And I think I might have seen a point where you could have done a cut. But the point is, it's fantastic style, and it's very, very visually engaging. And it's great fun to watch. And everything that's happening around Charlize Theron is superb. I just don't think she's got enough range to really make it work, unfortunately.
That is unfortunate. I mean, she's a very, very capable actress. And we've seen her in action movies like the Mad Max Fury Road. She played a very prominent role there and did it very well. But, maybe that's as much to do with the script and the director telling her to do it that way. Who knows?
Oh, quite possible. I think that's probably the failing there. Yeah, because she's capable. Yeah. We know she is.
Yeah. Well, I sort of... Yeah, you've left me partially interested, but not completely. So I'll have to let that sit and stew for a while. Hey, by the way, Steve... just while we're talking about it, you know, action movies and thrills and spills, have you seen, and I'm yet another, I've lost count, Marvel film, the last one to come out, called Spider-Man Homecoming?
I must have missed that one. No, that one passed me by.
Yeah, I can understand that, why it has been out. I can't speak English, which happens when you watch too many of these superhero movies. You start speaking in a strange language. It's been out for a few weeks. It's funny, I did see it, and it's kind of a sign, perhaps, of how commercially successful these Marvel superhero films have been. It's earned $670 million worldwide, and probably still a bit more to come. But I don't think it's actually the smash hit that the good people at Marvel were hoping for, by any means.
And I have to say, before we even start getting into your discussion of the film, I think we just identified two big problems here, first of all. The first one is the fact that $670 million isn't a smash hit anymore.
Yes.
And then secondly, the fact that you discuss that before you talk about anything else about the film. That's all that really matters, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, and I think that, you know what, they've done so many of them, they're trying to build this sort of ongoing story, because there is actually kind of one story that's running through all these films. So I guess how well they perform commercially is important to keeping it going and keeping the audience hooked into the story. So it is relevant. The question, of course, really is, Steve, is it any good? It is. And I think the ones you and I have seen, a few of these Marvel films, they do craft them pretty well, don't they? They tend to have decent action. They tend to have usually some good actors in there playing some of the key characters. And they generally tend to have a decent dose of humor so that they're not taking themselves too seriously. And that's probably been the secret of their success, I guess. And this does all those things. I don't think it lets the side down in any way. But do you know what? I don't know if you've seen any of the other ones. Any other attempts at Spider-Man. This is at least the third attempt at a Spider-Man film in relatively recent history. And I, for one, are a little Spider-Man out.
Oh, dear. That's not good, is it?
Well, and they must have considered all that, because we had Tobey Maguire, and then was that English actor Andrew Garfield playing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And now we've got another English actor, and he does it very well. Tom Holland is a very entertaining take on Peter Parker, Spider-Man. They've got a very good actor, Michael Keaton, playing the bad guy, and they give him actually a bit of backstory. He's kind of a working-class capitalist, if that makes sense.
Okay.
There's some good writing, but it's just, I don't know, maybe I'm just beginning to get to that saturation level of these films, which is unfortunate. And there's still more coming. They're being churned out left, right, and center, Steve. I'm not saying don't see it. If you like Spider-Man, you'll enjoy it. I'm just beginning to feel I'm getting a little bit of fatigue is creeping into my bones on this.
Well, again, I think it's very, very telling that you've not even, other than Michael Keaton, you've not mentioned anything of the superb backing cast. You've told us nothing of the story. This shows you how little this spoke to you. I think that's well, about, it's what you've not said is the most damning part of your review, quite frankly.
Yeah, well, I did enjoy it when I saw it, but there is a candy floss nature to these films now, isn't there? Because there is a bit of a formula that we're getting used to.
Yeah, emotions are being gone through, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. The only other things I would say is, I actually think the action sequences in all these films are the least memorable, because we're so used to what CGI can do now. If these films work, it's going to be because of the writing and the characters and a decent plot. And the other thing that is worth mentioning, and this film does do well, it copped a lot of flack in the early stages, Steve, because there was a lot of people saying, why don't we have a Spider-Man who's not white, who might be black or Hispanic or whatever. And what they've done is they've cast almost all the other actors around Spider-Man as from different ethnic backgrounds, Korean and black and Hispanic and all sorts.
Yes.
So they've done it that way. And actually that part worked very well, because what it showed was that these young people, and they're all teenagers at high school, the issue of their backgrounds wasn't commented on. They're just young people getting on, relating to each other, and that was done without sort of having to dwell on it. And so that was just – I thought that was done in a rather mature way. So I gave them a big tick for that. But I just kind of, getting a little bit superheroed out. Anyway, let's leave it at that.
Do I even need to ask you, should I buy a ticket for this?
Well, I don't think you should.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate that.
I don't think you should. I will still probably see the next one, but I'm just wondering whether they should actually call time on it at some point. Speaking of time, is it time?
Well done.
How did I do that?
That was outstanding.
I know. Look, hey, I've done this for a while now. It's your talent I'm feeding off, Steve.
Clearly.
You're going to tell me about a completely different event You went to spend an evening with a very well-known man who deals with aspects of time and space, does he not?
He does indeed. This is Neil deGrasse Tyson. And we're a bit late on our review here, but as you said, you know, it's been the winter holidays and we've all taken a bit of time off.
Yes.
But it's worth coming back and at least giving him a quick mention or two. Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I can tell you're not overly familiar with the name, is
well, I know he did this very famous series called Cosmos.
There you
he?
Go. That's the one. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And, anyway, and he's very much carving out a little niche as the latter day Carl Sagan. He's an American astrophysicist.
Yeah.
Who teaches at one of the I forget which now is it State University of New York? One of the New York universities. I should know this. And he's become, I'm speaking here as a science teacher. He's become something that he's really, really, really important. He's become a very talented science communicator. And,
yes.
And in this day and age, that's something that we just don't have enough of.
Okay.
And so he's now touring, bringing basically physics to the masses. And that's not an easy challenge.
No.
And so he basically gave us a slideshow, which he called The Cosmic Perspective.
Yeah.
It lasted for about half an hour initially, and it's basically a talk about how utterly insignificant we are on our tiny little blue-green planet.
Right.
It was lots of references to the famous pale blue dot photograph, where the entire of the Earth is nothing but a pale blue dot in the background of a photograph of Saturn. And so that was the initial part of it, and it was entertaining. And what makes it work is he is a very, very talented speaker. He's a very entertaining, very sharp, he clearly loves his subject. He's also very engaged. I know this dates the review just a little bit, but it was the day after the final test of the All Blacks British Lions tour.
Okay, yeah.
And he did actually go to great lengths to point out that since the Lions didn't score as many tries as the All Blacks, it should be correctly described as the All Blacks defeated the Lions 15-15. So clearly, not only is he a good speaker, he also knows his audience.
Yes, yes.
And takes the trouble to actually put a little bit of time into personalising his show for the audience. And then at the end of that, after, like I said, about 30, maybe 40 minutes slideshow, it was then a Q&A with the audience. And that's when it got really interesting, because that's when we saw that not only when he's prepared and scripted, but also when he's dealing with anything that's thrown at him to do with science, he can speak with astonishing breadth and insight. And it sounds like a hard sell, to be honest. You went to listen to a scientist talk at Vector Arena, and that's exactly what I did.
And yes.
All I can tell you is I am awfully, awfully glad I did.
Okay. Was there one little fact that stayed in your mind that he revealed that you still think about?
That's a really tricky one, to be honest. I mean, he did spend a while discussing the physics laws of the Super Mario universe.
Did he? Okay.
Which I thought was quite wonderful. But one thing that he did leave at the end, and again, speaking as a physics teacher, this is a comment that I took to heart very much. He did, in response to somebody who was asking a question that he was struggling to answer, and he quite cheerfully admitted he was struggling to answer it, and he finally said, look, it's like this. The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. And I thought, that'll do quite nicely. I'll take that.
Absolutely. Gosh, okay. Fantastic. Oh, well, thank you for bringing that up. It was good to have something really different to chat about in our podcast.
Raising the intellectual tone just a smidge at the end, yes.
Someone should.
Absolutely.
Steve, I think that we've had a lot to talk about. Then we've had a break for a few weeks, so it's nice to have a lot of topics to cover in our podcast this week. I think we should also just cast our eye ahead a little bit. Is there stuff coming up in the weeks and months ahead that you're particularly keen on catching up with?
There's not an enormous amount that's been announced just recently, no. It's kind of a quiet time, really, right now. Although I did get a very interesting email this afternoon I think it's Roadshow Studios, inviting me to the press screening of Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Yes, I got that too. And you might think when you hear that, that's an odd thing to do when it's a film which might be at least 20 years old, if not older.
Yes, exactly.
But it's got a little different take on it.
Well, apparently it's the blurb that we got in the email says it's James Cameron's epic action sci-fi masterpiece, and I think that's fair. It really is. Starring Arnold Schwarzenegger in his greatest role, has been converted to immersive 3D by Cameron himself. Now, Cameron's been a pioneer of 3D for quite some time, so I'm fascinated to see what he's done with this. And let's face it, it's an opportunity to see a thoroughly, thoroughly brilliant film in a new presentation, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think it'll be quite good. Yeah. Okay, great. Excellent. That's coming up quite soon. Good one. Hey, well, that's and if you want to hear anything else or check out what else is coming up, please do go to our website, cravepodcast.com. Steve does an excellent job keeping you up to date with little notices, and that covers, does it not, Steve, not just movies but music as well, concerts coming our way. So it's well worth checking out.
Absolutely. And we'd love to hear from you if anyone's got any comments on what we've had to say today. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is podcast@cravepodcast.com, or you can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Fantastic. So I am Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Very definitely. Ooh. That's some good stuff. That's 47 minutes.